and good morning. News time is 8:06. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this morning. And as I mentioned, it's a mild, beautiful temps in the 60s this morning here in the Wasatch Back. And here with more on the weather, on the phone with me from ABC4's Meteorology Center is Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Connor. Yeah, good morning, Park City, Heber. Looking at really nice conditions throughout much of the day today. We've got a little bit of moisture that should rotate up from the southwest, so mostly sunny to then partly cloudy skies into the afternoon. Models hinting at maybe a 10% chance of seeing a shower or storm, but I think for the most part it's going to be a gorgeous day. Temperatures near 87 again, so above average heat continuing. Into Tuesday, sunshine and upper 80s, so almost 90 degrees on Tuesday. We are going to track some changes midweek. Moisture rotating around a ridge of high pressure that's parked near the Four Corner region should bring a better chance of showers and storms Wednesday afternoon after a sunny start to Wednesday morning. Temperatures in the mid-80s for highs, about a 30 to 40% chance of seeing showers and storms Wednesday and on Thursday. Temperatures falling to the low 80s on Thursday for the highs as well. And then a near average day on Friday. We have a front that's going to slide through Thursday into Friday, dropping temperatures to mid-70s. So that's pretty average for Park City this time of year before we rebound again with high pressure into the weekend back into the mid to low 80s. So wet weather potential, plan on that Wednesday and Thursday. Heber looking at similar conditions. Hotter temperatures, of course, today 94 with sunshine. Small chance of a shower or storm this afternoon, 96 on Tuesday. We'll start to see temperatures slide through Thursday with partly cloudy skies on Wednesday. A chance of showers and storms, better chance of thunderstorms on Thursday. 87 for the high, and then we're in the mid-80s on Friday. Should feel really nice outside with sunshine, and a quick rebound as high pressure builds back into the low 90s by this next weekend.
All right. Thank you so much, Nate.
You bet.
And some construction around the Wasatch Back you may need to be aware of, particularly on 80 near 224 and 40. This construction in Summit County starts today. Utah Department of Transportation says it will improve infrastructure and safety. Beginning today, only one lane of eastbound I-80's off-ramp to Kimball Junction will be open while UDOT crews are repaving the exit and improving storm drains. The ramp will be reduced to a single lane as needed until late fall. Asphalt repairs on US 40 also begin today. The Highway 40 westbound flyover ramp to 80 will have shifting traffic patterns during repairs. And next month, there may be a three-week closure for some repaving. Sections of concrete on Highway 40 will also be replaced starting next month from 248 to I-80. UDOT reports it will use rapid-set concrete to keep lane closures to a minimum, though. Highway 40 will experience daytime single-lane closures as needed throughout the project during low traffic hours. Construction on the State Route 248 interchange will begin in mid-July. UDOT plans to upgrade storm drains, reconstruct the pedestrian ramp, and widen east and westbound off-ramps by Exit 4 toward Park City. The work will close the shoulder and shift travel lanes. Construction is going to be happening around the clock the next couple months. UDOT crews will work Monday through Friday, 6:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon, and Sunday through Thursday, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. These projects are expected to be completed later this fall. More information and real-time traffic updates, we've got those for you at kpcw.org. And while the Francis Planning Commission is recommending an annexation application for a new development between the Weber-Provo Diversion Canal and Lambert Lane, KPCW's Christine Weller reports the vote is split 2-1.
The commission's support for annexing three lots north of Francis now heads to the City Council for final approval. Local investor Richard Rapp with Annapurna Capital Partners LP made the application to create a conservation subdivision, a residential development with 50 to 70% of the space preserved as communal open space. The annexed area will be a total of 92 acres at Hallam Road and Lambert Lane, but only 25 acres will be developed, leaving 70% of the area as communal open space. Dubbed the Burton Ranch, the development will have over 100 housing units. City Planner Katie Henhues outlined the benefits and drawbacks of the annexation during the commission's meeting Thursday. She said the main benefit is the proximity of the open space to the city sewer ponds. Since they're adjacent, if the sewer facilities need to be expanded to accommodate growth, there is already a large buffer.
If the land is not annexed, future development would probably allow to occur next to the ponds, and so we would have to purchase a buffer property to make sure that we didn't have development right there.
Another benefit, Henyu said, is the annexation would be within the city's jurisdiction, which means Francis would decide what can happen with the land. One drawback is Summit County is planning to build a collector road from Hallam Road across the open space to State Route 248. Henyu said the city believes the road is needed, but is concerned about the cost if the area is annexed.
If we annex it into the city, then we would be responsible for that. There may be talk with the county and there may be funding available, but it's really not guaranteed.
The other issue is planned city growth. Francis wants to ensure it has enough suitable land for future housing development. Based on projections, the area will need another 500 units over the next 20 years. Those have already been approved within city limits, some as long as 20 years ago, but Henyu said it's unclear when they will actually be developed. Commissioner Kimberly Lawson argued approving the annexation would add problems as it's right next to permitted sites that don't yet have development plans. Hidden Meadows is down the road from the planned development, and Hart Crossing is across the street.
And my question really to the Planning Commission is, how do you define responsible growth? Is it putting 1,000 people within a half mile radius? Because that's basically what we're doing. I feel like we're turning it into heroin overnight.
Commissioner Justin Sampi said the pros outweighed the cons.
In this particular case, there's such an advantageous point to the protected space and to the buffer and to, essentially only developing a third of this, the bang for your buck, is where it turns for me.
Commissioner Sam Stable agreed. However, she emphasized the importance of homeownership.
It's extremely important that we enable our kids and our workers, our service workers, to have somewhere to live so that they're not pushed out by secondary homes and vacation homes and multi-million dollar mansions.
The commission voted 2-1 to approve the annexation, with Lawson opposed. The approval carries some staff-recommended conditions, including completing a wetland study, widening the collector road to 70 feet, updating the concept plan so homes can't be accessed via the collector road, performing an intersection study, and having at least 50% of all homes in the development be owner-occupied units. Locals can provide public comment on the Burton Ranch annexation when the proposal is heard by the Francis City Council. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Coming up on the program today, going to be speaking with hydrologist Matt Linden about water levels here locally and around the state. Then Eve First, she's Summit County's clerk, is going to talk about tomorrow's primary election. Finally, we wrap up Local News Hour with Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff introducing Becca Gerber, their new Director of Community and Government Relations over there at the Chamber. Well, here with me in the studio now is Matt Linden. He's a hydrologist and a Snyderville Basin resident. We're going to be talking water levels. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Connor.
So I know you live right behind Willow Creek. What are you seeing out there right now?
That is the great thing. It's in my backyard. I see it every day. I hear it every night. And Willow Creek was pretty indicative of everything around the Wasatch Front and Uintas. You know, everything peaked around June 8th, June 9th. And we peaked about, between 100, 150% of normal. But nothing out of the ordinary, nothing amazing. We didn't really read any action items or hit peak levels. Typically around here, when the snow melts, you know, an inch or two a day, it comes off and you almost don't even notice it.
Yeah, you mentioned we peaked earlier in June. I know the National Weather Service sent out kind of a flood watch kind of for the Oakley area around that time. I don't think we saw anything severe that day, though. Anything severe around the state at all to report from this year's runoff?
Not that I'm aware of. There was that warning for Oakley, and Oakley's important because there's a big diversion there that sends water over to the Provo River, and so they're pretty sensitive of how they split that up. We did some work in Oakley Town, reclaiming an old meander for Oakley City, and that was put through the paces of a high flow, but we never got to an action item. We never got through a flood stage.
Gotcha. And when you say we, do you mean the hydrologists that you work with?
Yes, and then I've been working with Oakley City as well. They bought some land and put a little horse park and bike park out there, and it's worked out really well. It's great to see it at high flows and then at low flows and see how it held up.
Okay, gotcha. And I was checking, you know, the Utah snowpack chart this morning, and I saw we've melted just about everything in the state at this point. So are we at the point where we can start making some conclusions about the runoff and the snowpack in this water year?
Yeah, I think at this point we can make some pretty accurate you know, we've had our peak flows, 2,000, 3,000 CFS on the Weber and Provo respectively. And then, you know, we can look at how much volume are we expecting, say 130,000 acre feet for the Provo and a little less than that for the Weber. And remembering that we measure flow in CFS, cubic feet per second, and that's about the size of a basketball that weighs 64 pounds. And we measure volume in acre feet, which is about a football field with 1 acre, with 1 foot of water on it. And so all the reservoirs around here are full and spilling. We had a good year last year. We had some holdover and everything filled up. We were about, 120%, 130% of normal snowpack. And we had a decent runoff from that. And it was pretty classic. It is almost a double peaking runoff where the low snow and the south facing snow, went, early May. And then the higher snow and the north facing snow came in June. And so it was all very orderly and it came as it should.
That's good. And I know at least in the beginning of the melt, we had that stair step pattern too. You said about an inch or two per day.
Yeah,
how does that compare to like last year's melt, for example?
And last year wasn't crazy, but if you get an inch or two a day, that's like getting an inch or two of rain a day and everything can handle it. But you start getting 3 or 4 inches of runoff a day from, all aspects and all elevations. That's when you get the flooding. And like you said, we had that stair step where it came off nice and orderly. Typically, historically, our big runoff would come in June. But over the past 50 to 100 years, that has slid now, and our runoff comes in May, and it's pretty much done by June at this point. And so much of it depends on the weather in May. You could have a small snowpack with a hot May, and you can get flooding, or you could have a huge snowpack with a nice May and not get any flooding at all. So it is now contingent on that climate in May.
Oh, and I wanted to return to what you said about cubic feet per second and kind of how people in your industry measure these flows.
Yes.
I'm curious, those are the units, but where are you choosing to measure them in the river? Because these are kind of squirrely things, different widths at different areas.
Right.
How do you do that?
Typically the USGS does that kind of measuring, and they have spots and have gauges all across the state, and they have, hardened cross-sections so they know what the depth translates into flow. And there's a nice one in Oakley. There's a nice one at Hailstone. There's one in Woodland. And the amazing thing is the gauges in Oakley and the gauges in Woodland for the Provo and Weber River have almost exactly the same drainage basin size. And it all comes from up in Trial Lake. So it's really, really easy, and it's really good to be able to compare those two rivers.
And I think you mentioned 130,000 cubic feet per second for the Provo, or is that acre feet?
That's acre feet, yes. That's how much volume we're getting out of the Provo.
Is that a lot or a little when you're looking at like the historic trends?
An acre foot can support, say, 2 to 4 houses with 2 to 4 people in each house. So it's just a substantial amount of water. But we've taken a look at both the Provo and the Weber, and we've noticed over the last 100 years that each river is losing 350 acre feet a year. And you're thinking, well, that's not a big deal. Between the two rivers, 700 acre feet a year, big deal out of 130,000. But you multiply that out, you scale that out over 100 years, and we're losing, 70,000 acre feet over that 100 years. That's 250,000 houses. That's enough water for 1 million people. So we've seen over the last 100 years, those rivers are flowing less water, enough water to supply 1 million people. So that's why we have so much interest in water around here, and also interest in water going down into the Great Salt Lake.
Do you know why we're losing that water? Is it because we're using it, or is it because of other factors, maybe climate related?
I think it's a combination of everything. We're using a lot more of it. Maybe there's more being diverted illegally above some of these gauges. But there's definitely a climate change component to this. We've seen this in the snowpack. We've seen this in the runoff. We see how much comes, when it comes, and we see. Things changing, and it's not only just over the last 100 years, but it's really over the last 20, 25 years that our runoff has come in May rather than June. And so any kind of changes that we're seeing them accelerate.
And with the hundreds of thousands of acre feet in water headed to the Wasatch Front, how much of that actually ends up in like the Great Salt Lake or Utah Lake? How much, you know, seeps into the ground? How much do they lose along the way?
That is a good question, because a lot of it seeps into our ground. A lot of it goes to, 80% of our water goes to natural vegetation out there. And so we're only getting 20% of that, you know, and out of that 20%, 80% of that seeps into the ground. And that's not lost. That goes down into our groundwater, and it's water that we can pump out and use. And so how we get it and where it comes from is coming from different places. But at the end of the day, we use most of it. We try to use most of it, and not much of it goes to the Great Salt Lake. So any kind of additional water for the Great Salt Lake is going to take a lot of effort, a lot of political effort, to let that water go and recharge that lake.
I guess some gets captured in reservoirs too. How are reservoir levels doing? Any good indications? It feels like it's been a pretty wet couple of years.
Yeah, where, you know, we've had a couple good years. The reservoir levels are up. But that doesn't mean we're out of the woods. You know, last year the Great Salt Lake went up 5 feet. That was wonderful, but it went down 3 from evaporation. This year it goes up 3, and it'll probably lose that 3. So realistically, even with these good years, we're only holding our own with the Great Salt Lake level. And it's a similar situation with the Colorado River. We had a good year, but the rest of the drainage basin did not. They only had maybe 80% of their snowpack, and may expect only 75% of the runoff. And so Lake Powell is kind of holding steady at this point. So, you know, a couple good years, we kind of forget about water, and we go along our merry way, but we're not out of the woods with any one of these issues.
I guess, yeah, we don't hold our own until we're doing maybe larger things. There's always that conversation in the background rumbling about draining Lake Powell. Are you plugged into that at all? And explain that conversation.
You know, we've been looking at that for, you know, 20 years, and it used to be a political sort of affair. And now it's becoming more of an operational kind of affair, that there's not enough water in Lake Powell to push the water through penstocks and make electricity, or even push water through the bottom of the dam to keep enough water in the Grand Canyon. So the actual plumbing of the situation is coming into question. And so I think there still is a lot of discussion about maybe consolidating Lake Powell into Lake Mead.
I'm curious also about how the amount of water that we get in these reservoirs changes the reservoirs themselves. I was at Jordanelle this weekend, and I was noticing it's pretty high right now.
Yeah.
The shoreline I was on, they're kind of like dirt cornices forming. Like the water was eroding underneath me. I nearly fell in.
Right.
You know, how does that water level change these reservoirs sort of as we see these good water years?
Yeah, you can see what Jordanelle is just about full at this point. And they're pretty good about predicting this stuff and filling these things up and not spilling them and not wasting the water. And the amazing thing with these reservoirs, they're like upside down pyramids, and so most of the storage is at the top end of it. And so to get those reservoirs full and be able to predict that has been pretty good. 30 years ago, we had no idea really how much was coming and where it was going to go. Now we do a great job with it. And I got to say, a hydrologist friend of mine, Brian McInerney, who was always the climate change guy at the National Weather Service when it wasn't a popular thing to be, he's working on some artificial intelligence that's going to help us better predict how much snow runoff we're going to have, how much storage we're going to be able to use. And that kind of information will be worth its weight in gold if we can manage our water resources better.
Okay, I was going to ask you if you had a crystal ball for next year. That sounds like that's the crystal ball, but it's not ready yet. Can you say anything about next year?
You know, there's two schools of thought. There's persistence that the weather will, you know, continue to go as, and we're going to have more good years, you know, and we tend to dress for yesterday's weather. But I think in the long run, we're in a more of a drought situation, and these past 2 years have been the anomaly, like, say, 83 and 84, and I expect us to get back to a more normal situation in the years to come.
Gotcha. All right. I think I'm out of questions for you, Matt. Anything else you want to mention?
Nope. I appreciate the opportunity to come up here and speak with you.
Definitely. All right. We've been speaking with Matt Linden. He's a hydrologist and a local Summit County resident. Thank you
yes.
so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Well, a car crash in Heber City Thursday killed one person. KPCW's Christine Weller reports.
A fatal head-on collision June 20th occurred on Highway 40 in Heber. Corporal Haley Shear from the Utah Highway Patrol said a Ford F-150 was traveling west when it entered oncoming traffic to pass another vehicle.
After passing the vehicle, the F-150 stayed in the oncoming travel lane and it hit another vehicle, which was a Dodge Ram. And that Dodge Ram was pulling a flatbed trailer.
The 39-year-old driver of the Ford truck died on the scene due to the head-on collision. The driver and passenger in the Dodge Ram truck went to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Here with me on the phone, I've got Summit County Clerk Eve Firsch. She's going to be telling us a little bit about tomorrow's primary election. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. So June 25th, Utah primary elections are tomorrow. Maybe just start by summarizing, what are some of the different ways that Utahns can vote?
Sure. So today is the last day to put a ballot in a mailbox. If they want to do that, they should really ensure to get the ballot postmarked with today's date, because if it has a later date, it won't be counted. So that's the first way to vote. The second way to vote is to take the ballot you received in the mail and put it in a drop box. And you can do that anytime between now and tomorrow at 8 p.m. has to be in before 8 p.m. to a drop box. And then lastly, they can vote in person today or tomorrow. And early voting today is at the Richens building out at Kimball Junction. And that is from 8 a.m. this morning until 1 p.m. this afternoon. And also they can vote out in here in Colville at the courthouse between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. today. And then, of course, tomorrow being Election Day, we open at 7 a.m. and we'll be open until 8 p.m. And we have four locations for voting tomorrow. And that's Colville City Hall, the Marsac Building, Park City Hall, the Richens Building out in out at Kimball Junction, and then also the Camas County building in Camas.
All right, and I really want to mention for people that tomorrow's Election Day, but today is that last day to postmark your mail-in ballot if you'd like to do it by the Postal Service. Does it need to be postmarked by a particular time today?
No, just has to have today's date on it.
All right, gotcha. Do you have a sense for, you know, how many people or what percentage of Summit County's electorate has voted already?
Yes. Well, so it depends how you calculate it. Not everybody received a ballot for this election because it's a primary. And so of the people who've received ballots, I think we're at about a 20% turnout rate at this point.
All right. Does that indicate that this could be a higher turnout primary than, previous ones? Or where does that stack up historically?
I think we're about on schedule with previous primaries. So looking back at the last three federal primaries, I think we were at about a 45% turnout rate, and I'm expecting the same for this one.
All right. And primaries, of course, vary by party in Utah. Republican primaries are closed. Dems do open primaries. Can you explain a little bit about what that means for voters tomorrow?
Sure. So the thing to understand is that a primary is what it helps a party decide who's going to represent them on the ballot in November. And so they get to make choices about who can vote in their own primary. So the Republican Party has decided that in order to vote on who their candidates will be, you have to be a registered Republican. That is considered a closed primary. And if you are a member of a different party, it's too late to change affiliations. That had to happen back in January. But if you're an unaffiliated voter, which there are a very large number of in Summit County, an unaffiliated voter still can affiliate as a Republican and then choose to vote in the Republican primary if they would like. And to do that, they would have to come and vote in person either today or tomorrow. The Democratic primary, by contrast, is an open party or open primary, which means anybody can vote in that primary. You may not have received a ballot at home, but if you want to vote in that primary, you can come in to one of the in-person voting sites today or tomorrow and ask to vote the Democratic ballot, and they will let you do that. The last type of election we have is just in the South Summit School Board. Seat 2, which is for Camas, they have a nonpartisan primary. All of our local school boards are nonpartisan, and that's the only school board seat that has more than two people running for it. So we have a primary in that to narrow the race to two people. So that area has a nonpartisan. So even if you don't want to vote in the Republican or Democratic primary, you would have received a ballot for the Camas school board race and can vote that.
Gotcha. I'm curious, can a registered Republican or like an unaffiliated voter vote in both the Republican and the Democratic primaries, or will they need to choose one for their ballot?
They need to choose one. It is considered one election. And so they can only vote in one. And so if they've returned a mail-in ballot, we will have counted that vote and they will come up as having already voted and will not be permitted to vote in another election. If there's confusion about whether that happened or not, they'll be given the opportunity to vote provisionally, and then we'll sort out which ballot we received and whether it was appropriately reviewed.
Oh, so sometimes your internal system actually catches duplicate voters, and that kind is a stopgap. Yeah.
Yes. Each ballot has a unique identifier. Each ballot we mail out has a unique identifier number that traces both to the ballot and the person. And so when that comes back and we scan that in and check the signature, we are able to know whether that person voted or not. And if they have already voted, it won't actually let us register that ballot in the system. And likewise, if you try and vote in person, when they scan your ID, if you've already been given vote credit, it will give an alert, and the poll worker will let you know that you have that it looks like you've already voted.
And I know it's kind of customary to test your voting machine or your vote counting machine at the clerk's office before elections. Did you do that prior to the primaries?
Yes, we did. We did that back on June 3rd, we had our what we call our logic and accuracy testing for all of our voting equipment, and it all passed the test with flying colors. So everything is calculating correctly as far as making sure that votes given to one candidate are being received by that candidate. And so we did that, and then we will also conduct a post-election audit on July 1st. Where we will look at 1% of the ballots received and make sure that they were actually counted correctly by the voting equipment to make sure that the right candidates are receiving the votes that have been indicated on the ballots.
Gotcha. Could you describe a little bit about kind of the security measures you take with people's ballots once they are received by the clerk's office?
Sure. So we have, if a ballot's been dropped in a drop box, or you cast your vote at a vote center, or you put them in the mail and they got to our post office, two people always together pick up those ballots and they place them in a receptacle, which then is either zip tied and it has a unique identifier on the tag, or it has a seal on it, a tamper evidence seal on the receptacle to indicate what the number is and whether it's been opened, and then those two people return it to our office, which is received here, and that's all on, when it gets to our office, it's all on camera at that point. And then we check the seal numbers or the zip tie numbers to make sure those match, and then once they're here, they're always in locked rooms, and they're counted and kept in batches and recounted at every step of the process to make sure none are lost, and that we have the right number of batch numbers. There are no additional batch numbers, or that there are not too few numbers, and then maintained all the way. And then the room they're kept in is can only be accessed if two people access it together. It's on a key card, and two people have to check in at the same time to be able to get into that room. And this is all on video.
All right. And, you know, just summarizing what people can expect on their ballot, I think there are a host of state and federal races, particularly on the Republican ballot. I think locally it's just Democrats running for Summit County Council seat C, and then the nonpartisan South Summit Board seat 2 that you mentioned. Am I missing any locally?
The Democrats in Summit Park, they have a Senate House race that they can vote for, District 23.
Gotcha. And if voters are interested, how should they find locations of drop boxes, polling places, hours, all of those things?
So they can find them on our site at summitcounty.org/elections. And they can also, a lot of people prefer to use the vote.utah.gov site. And that site allows you to you put in your address and it'll tell you what will be on your ballot. And it will also tell you where you can vote, like where the closest voting location is. The vote.utah.gov site also has an option to go to results so that you can have the most up-to-date results as well.
Gotcha. All right. Eve, anything else you want to mention today?
I think we just really want to encourage people to get out and vote. The best way to make sure you have your candidate that you want to vote for in November is on the ballot is to vote for them today.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you very much. Take care.
All right, we've been speaking with Summit County Clerk Eve Furse about primary election day in Utah. That's tomorrow, June 25th. Well, the Park City Council approved the fiscal year 2025 budget Thursday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports that includes millions for local transportation projects.
On Thursday, the City Council unanimously approved the $98 million operating budget for the next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The city has allocated money for a variety of capital projects, including adding sidewalks to Homestake Road, bus stop enhancements around town, and increasing bike and pedestrian access in Thanes. Park City Mayor Nan Worrell said the infrastructure investments are important to keep the town running during busy periods.
I think that this budget really reflects our commitment to public service. And how do we keep the high level of service that we do for a relatively small town? We're 8,500 people, but we swell to 80,000, for example, during Sundance. And so we have to have the services to be able to accommodate that and to have that flux. Our residents demand a high level of service, as well they should. And so we want to make sure that our budget reflects that priority.
City staff, along with the mayor and council, are getting a roughly 2% pay increase. The new budget also includes $3.5 million to bury transmission lines in Bonanza Park, an area that is slated for future development. The council also set aside $75,000 to plan for the 2034 Winter Olympics. With the retirement of a general obligation bond, taxpayers will enjoy a drop in the city's portion of their tax bills by about $70 for a home valued at $2.3 million. For more details on how Park City Municipal is spending tax dollars, visit kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And keeping an eye on traffic in the Wasatch Back. Not seeing a major backup yet growing off of the Kimball Junction exit of eastbound 80. UDOT's reporting, maybe a little bit slower than usual. There is some construction there expected to start today. That includes some off-ramp repaving that may reduce traffic to one lane on the eastbound 80 off-ramp at Kimball Junction. There is also repaving beginning on US 40 that could impact your morning commute today. I am seeing a backup on the eastbound 80 exit onto 40, as per usual, kind of. So budget that time into your morning commute this morning. Well, local wastewater treatment plants are still measuring COVID-19 levels, and KPCW's Christine Weller reports they want to test for more viruses than just that.
The Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District Director Mike Lurs said the organization has seen an increase in COVID-19 levels at both its treatment plants. During May, the East Canyon facility dropped down a little bit, and the Silver Creek facility saw levels increase.
And this is a trend that we've been seeing pretty much for the last couple months where you see a little bit of increase and it drops back down. But I think it's a reminder for folks that, SARS-CoV-2 virus is still with us.
Lurs said Colville has low COVID-19 levels and the Wasatch County Health Department is reporting low concentrations for Heber and Midway as well. Further, despite COVID-19 not being as much of a concern these days, Lurs said the local water district and other similar entities will continue to test for the virus.
It's been proven that you can look at wastewater is kind of the canary in the coal mine type situation, where if you're not looking only for, say, SARS-CoV-2, but you're looking for polio or influenza or resistant bacteria, wastewater is a good place to see what's happening with the general population.
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is currently developing wastewater-based epidemiology projects to expand testing to other viruses. The federal agency recently expanded the Airport Genomic Surveillance Project to test wastewater for new SARS-CoV-2 variations at 8 international airports in the U.S. The program is meant to serve as a warning system for other viral outbreaks. Lurs said the CDC tests the total wastewater coming out of the airports, but also tests specific airport wings.
If a particular terminal, say, serves international travel from Africa or Asia or wherever, and they pick up something, at least you kind of got an idea of where it's coming from.
Lurs said the United States Agency of International Development is monitoring wastewater in other parts of the world to prevent the spread of zoonotic diseases, which jump from animals to humans, like Ebola. The Salt Lake County Health Department tests wastewater samples for Summit County using funding from the CDC, and Lurs said he hopes the organization will provide more funding to test for more viruses. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Here with me in the studio is the Park City Chamber President and CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff and former Park City Council member, new position to announce, Becca Gerber. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
All right. So, Becca, you're the new Director of Community and Government Relations. Do I have that title right at the Chamber?
Yes, you do.
All right. So it's a new position. Jennifer, why did you choose to create this position?
It's actually not so much of a new position. We did transform our events position into this position about a year ago. And the purpose of it is really to help us better keep our pulse on the issues that are happening in the community, at local governments, and in the region about issues that are important to our members, important to our stakeholders, and make sure that business and stakeholders have a voice at the table.
So it's not just events. What's been added kind of in your day-to-day besides that old position?
A lot of meetings at the county and the city level, really making sure that the chamber's opinions about issues related to development, housing, business needs, business vibrancy are at the table when those issues are discussed. Becca will lead our legislative policy agenda. So about 3 years ago was the first time the Chamber and Visitors Bureau created a legislative policy agenda to really reflect the policy statements that are important to our business community. So Becca this year will help us develop that. We'll work with our HPCA, our Lodging Association, and our Restaurant Association in hopes that they will also sign on to that agenda. And then we take that and those policy statements, we take that to our local officials, our state officials, and our federal officials so that they know where the Park City Chamber businesses stand on important issues like regulation and taxation and labor and housing and environment issues. So it's a really important tool for us, and you can find that policy statement that was actually approved and signed on by the HPCA Lodging and Restaurant Association last year on our website at parkcitychamber.com.
Gotcha. So the position was announced, I think, earlier this month. Becca, have you started any of that yet? Sort of what's your day-to-day like right now?
Yes, so I have started. My first day was officially May 28th, so I've been in not quite a month. And my day-to-day, really to Jennifer's point, has been meeting with many of our trade industries. I've been going to HPCA meetings, PCAALA, Park City Area Lodging Association, the Restaurant Association, following city and county meetings, and really trying to make sure that I'm abreast of the big issues with all of these organizations, that I can report back to the chamber at large, and also still learning what is important, kind of the party line of our chamber and what we want to be pushing out to the community and bringing back in. And as many of our community people in our community know, they recently went through the Mountain Kind rebrand. And so I'm excited to share that message and help take that out from the chamber, bring that to the community, and also hear how that reflects and reverberates and how we can really spread that. To me, it's one of the things that I'm really most excited about being with the chamber, because I think it represents not just a branding for the chamber, but really who we want to be as a community. And as someone raising children here in this community, I'm really excited for us to be able to work with our young people coming up and spread that and really embrace that messaging, especially as we look forward to the Olympics in 2034.
Mm-hmm. How have some of your past like governmental and business experiences played into the job that you're doing now?
I think they play in really well. Before I started at the city, I was working, and I have been working with Aloha Ski and Snowboard and Bonhof for over 11 years. And the interesting thing about that organization is that they also have sister stores across Colorado. So I've been really tracking well with the ski industry and issues that have come up in as far as our winter season, winter sports, event cycles. And so I think that I'm really able to represent some of the issues that our ski industry has seen and how that really fits into our community overall. I've also, my husband owns a small business here in town, so I've watched him and what he's had to work through and some of his struggles and opportunities that he's seen in his business. And then also being on city council and having that connection with our community overall. I've done a lot of work with our residents and with our nonprofits, hearing what's important to people, what they want to see, where they're feeling pressure. And I think that being able to bring all those different sides to the table at the chamber is going to really help me excel in this role.
So Jennifer, when you decided you kind of wanted to hire for this role, did you recruit Becca directly, put out applications? Sort of how did you decide she was the right person for the job?
We posted the position as we do the majority of our positions at the chamber, and had some really great candidates apply for it. But as Becca said, with her experience and knowledge of the Park City issues and the Summit County issues, it was just so easy for her to hit the ground running. You know, every year we do a business survey that isn't just for our members, but it's a broad Summit County survey. And we ask our businesses, what are the top issues facing your business in the upcoming year? And one of the results actually surprised me. The number one concern and issue that our businesses told us was sense of place and community character. That's something that's so important to them, that we preserve that, along with things like labor supply, state and local regulations, affordable and employee housing, employee transit and commute time rose this year on the level of importance for our businesses, as well as some interesting topics that maybe in some communities wouldn't rise to the top, like waste, compost, and recycling issues, climate change, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. So these are all the issues that through Becca's experience and work moving forward will guide some of the work that we do in these areas.
Gotcha. And in the announcement, Becca, you spoke a little bit about, you know, increasing services for some of the community's most vulnerable, and I think, you know, really paying attention to those labor issues. Could you give examples of some of those things you're making a priority right now?
So it is called out in the Chamber Sustainable Tourism Plan, but also in every single meeting I've gone to, affordable housing is one of the number one issues for our community, whether it's speaking to our school district, our business community, individual industries. And also, I even was at a meeting this week with UVU talking about their Wasatch Resort Management Program. And that was one of the number one issues that they say they're facing. So it really is an issue that is countywide, if not statewide, if not nationwide. So I think that's one of the areas that I've always passionately advocated for. And so I look forward to being able to advocate for continuing my advocacy in that area. And then we do, as we look towards having, you know, again, the Olympics come in, who we are as a community, being able to speak to diversity, equity, and inclusion and what that means for our community. Being an inclusive and welcoming community is so important. So I look forward to exploring ways that we can continue to support that piece of the mission as well.
Yeah,
expanding programs like the resource guide, the mm-hmm. seasonal workforce guide that we have online. It's a great partnership with the city and the county and a lot of our larger businesses who bring in seasonal workers and our nonprofit groups to make sure that those seasonal workers who are coming in, particularly in the wintertime, know what resources are available to them and can easily access them. So we'll look to further expand programs like that. along with working with both the Community Foundation and folks here at KPCW on a candidate forum for the upcoming election. So a lot of great work to be done, and we're really happy to have Becca be able to lead that for us at our team.
Cool. And, you know, I don't know if you came in prepared to talk about tourism, but Savor the Summit was this weekend. Do you have any takeaways? Were you out there?
Connor, I am always prepared to talk about tourism in Park City.
Any numbers
Summit
you
County.
Have, you can throw out.
Yes, I was at Savor the Summit. It was wonderful to see so many locals out. It was a beautiful night. It looked like a flawless event, and a lot of people out on our historic Main Street having fun. I know that's something that's really important to our Main Street district, is that we continue to find ways to bring both visitors and locals alike to our historic Main Street, and events like that are really important to keep that vibrancy and that community character, which is so important to all of us. As we look at summer business in terms of tourism, we are getting a little bit of a slow start, like a lot of our mountain towns are telling us. We're looking at data now in two different ways, basically. When we look at occupancy data, we're looking at our condo properties and a lot of our luxury properties, and also our more traditional types of properties. So when we look at that, for May, our more condo-type properties and luxury properties finish at about 17% occupancy, where our more traditional hotel-type properties finished in the low 30s. So a little bit higher average occupancy for those more traditional-type properties, but still down compared to last May, about 6%. And looking forward to June, also a little bit of a slow start, seeing a slower pace compared to this time last year, down about 7%. But our rates are a little bit higher. So as we get into June and those booking, well, these numbers are as of May 31st. So as we see the results coming in for June, we certainly will see that occupancy rise and those rates lower as people are booking closer. The other thing that we're looking at is, how did we perform the last 6 months, and what are we looking forward to the next 6 months? As we look at the last 6 months, we're about flat compared to where we were this time last year, up just about 2%. Rates are about flat, and that occupancy for those 6 months is about 47%. So about half of our properties are full for the last 6 months. Looking forward, a similar story, a little bit slower pace. Occupancy for the next 6 months right now is at about 22% average occupancy, which is down about 4%.
And I was listening to your presentation at the Summit County Council a few weeks ago, and there was some discussion about booking window. Mm-hmm. I guess industry-wide, there might be this trend of a booking window shrinking. Is that something you see here in Park City, in our local market?
Absolutely. Our hotels tell that. That's a little bit of a harder number to capture through our data. So a lot of that is really anecdotal. And when we talk to our lodging partners, and we know the impacts of COVID really changed the way people travel, and, you know, they're waiting a little bit last minute in order to make sure that everyone in their families can still travel. They're waiting and they're watching pricing of airlines and gas prices. So we know that booking window is shrinking a little bit. So looking at those next 6 months, knowing that right now we're down only about 4%, I anticipate that we're going to finish the season virtually even with where we finished last year.
All right. Anything else you want to mention right now?
I'm just so excited to jump into this new role and get to work with Jennifer and the whole team over at Visit Park City. They're truly an excellent group of people, and I'm excited to get rolling.
Yeah, we have such great events coming up, too, that you can check out at parkcitychamber.com. We have our Oakley Rodeo coming up on July 3rd. That's a partnership with Summit County, where we're inviting legislators from the region and the state to join us to get to know us a little bit better. So we're really looking forward to that. And we also set the date for our annual meeting. So please mark your calendar for September 4th. It'll be a breakfast meeting from 9 to 11 at the Pendry Park City, and we hope to see all of our members there.
All right, sounds good. We've been speaking with Park City Chamber President and CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff and Becca Gerber, the new Director of Community and Government Relations at the Chamber. Thank you to both of you.
Thanks
you so much.